And welcome to Through the Pinard, your conversational podcast talking to midwives around the world about the research they are doing to improve midwifery practice. This research can range from small quality improvement programs and projects to those starting partway through or just finishing their postgraduate studies, and to those that have been there, done that, and got the t-shirt. So settle back and enjoy the conversation. And remember, you can continue the conversation on Twitter after you finish listening. Thank you very much for joining me, as per usual. Would you like to introduce yourself, please?
So thank you so much for having me today here, Liz. My name is Melissa Newman, and I'm in the second year of my professional doctorate in England. I qualified as a midwife just over 4 years ago, and since then I've completed a master's in genomic medicine, had several articles published in various midwifery journals. I also presented my work at the Royal College of Midwives Conference. I've helped write trust guidelines, and I recently won an alumni award from the university that I did my midwifery degree at. So I was very shocked and humbled, but honoured to win that.
That was, congratulations, I saw that. That was that's really quite nice, and you've packed a lot in these 4 years.
Yeah, I've tried to pack in as much as I can in a short space of time. Not quite sure why I feel the need to do it all at once, but there's so much that I want to achieve in my career. So, yeah, I'm just trying to do as much as I can, really. I've always had an interest in genetics.
Yeah.
And I always knew that I wanted to do a PhD as well. So I decided I'd do a master's in genomic medicine, sort of to bridge the gap between my undergraduate degree in midwifery and a PhD.
So what area specifically did you look at in that master's then?
So it's very broad. I did like counselling modules and like modules in laboratories and things. I did my thesis on secondary findings in genomic medicine, which I find really interesting. So that's where you have a test for one thing, but they find another secondary finding, in this case, a genomic finding. So it was a very broad master's. People on my course could go into various careers with it, but I always knew that I didn't want to do my PhD in a genomic subject, and I wanted to bring it back to midwifery. But doing my master's in genomics has definitely improved my midwifery knowledge in terms of antenatal screening. So it has benefited my midwifery practice as well.
What came out of your master's then? What were your findings from your master's that could be applicable for any midwife doing antenatal screening and appointments?
So in my degree, certainly, we learned about antenatal screening and how to discuss this with the people that we're caring for, but it's a very basic understanding.
Yep.
From my perspective. And so it just taught me all the ins and outs of the specifics and what the laboratory does as well. And obviously as midwives, we know the different options that we can counsel women about. And certainly in the UK, we then refer women to specialist antenatal screening midwives. So the actual, for example, when I was a community midwife, my sort of spiel about antenatal screening was fairly short, shorter than I would have liked. Then we give people the booklet to go away and read up on, and then they either consent or don't consent to it. It's very basic, but my master's just opened my eyes to what a sort of vast subject it is and how little of it we know as midwives.
Well, yeah, and I think unless you're in that area, there's a lot. And it actually brings me to a conversation I had today, quite ironically, we were talking about genetic testing, and we were talking about it in the for the BRCA gene and looking at whether to get it done or not. And my comment was, well, if it's not going to change your behavior, is there any point in getting it done if it's not going to change the way you live your life? So we're having a nice little debate about that. So what is the thinking around, because I know that testing, especially within testing for Down syndrome, that I've heard midwives say that would the result change what you're going to do? And they've gone no. So what do you recommend in those situations? To be tested or not be tested?
So I don't recommend anything. I just discuss with the women or birthing people. I do pose that question, would it change your decision? However, even if it wouldn't change their decision, it's some women also would like to know that they're going to have a baby with a trisomy.
Yep.
So, you know, it just, because then they can prepare both themselves mentally, physically, their family and friends if they want to as well. I think mental preparation is so important, because I have cared for women who did decline screening, and then at birth, they then have to find out, and it was massive shock for them. And one woman in particular I'm remembering back to right now, she sort of berated herself for not having the, you know, because the screening is quite simple in that, and that it was just really sad, because she completely blamed herself, and she was not to blame at all for this. Yeah. But she, in that situation, she personally wished that she had had the screening just so that she could prepare.
And there is so much of availability of support groups and information that if you do know ahead of time, then you are forewarned.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Because support groups are such a huge part of it as well. You know, there's antenatal support groups and charities as well. So, yeah. But if people don't want to find out, then that's up to them. And, you know, it is still fairly rare. So the chances are that they won't. But, you know, everyone's different. Everyone's an individual. What's right for one person isn't right for another. Women often ask me, what would you do? And I don't tell them what I would do, because it's not up to me. I don't want to influence their decisions. And also I'm making that, I would be making that decision from a midwife's point of view. So, you know, what would be right for me isn't right for someone else.
And it brings it all back to that, for women and families to be able to make a truly informed consent, they need to be able to be given all the information and given time to actually take it in and actually ask those questions in a way that is not feeling pressured or is not feeling biased, but is actually open.
Yeah, absolutely. So at antenatal booking appointments, well, in the UK, we don't ask anyone to make a decision right then. When I was a student at midwife, actually, we did. They had to sign a form at the booking appointment, having only just found out about this a couple of minutes before. But luckily now, well, certainly at the trust I worked at, they don't do that anymore. The women just go away, you know, they have the information leaflets and are told about other resources to look at online. They can discuss it with their partner or family or friends or whoever to make that decision. And then at the scan and the dating scan, that's when they then make the decision. So that is a few weeks later.
Yeah. I mean, otherwise it's just, yeah, it's illogical with some of the pressure that we put on people to make decisions without giving them a chance to cognitively actually think it over.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of the time people say, oh, well, my friend did it, or my sister did it, so I'll do it. And they don't really understand the implications. For example, if they did get a high risk result, then they think, oh, what do I do now? So they do need to understand that some people do get high risk results, and then what their options are from there.
Mm. The importance of, we always keep coming back to the importance of antenatal education in a whole pile of different things that helps prevent kind of like postnatal complications, but also that increasing in antenatal stress, because if you know what you're dealing with, then you can put a name to it and you can actually find a way of dealing with it better.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So then from there you went on to your PhD.
Yes.
Now that's in an even, that's a completely different area.
Yes. Yeah, so then I went into my third discipline.
So how did you get into that area?
So I've always known that I've wanted to do a PhD. I remember first thinking this when I was at school, and a couple of my teachers were professors or doctors, but I was too shy and reserved to ask them why they had a different title to everyone else. So I researched it myself, and I was just amazed at what they'd achieved. And I thought, that's what I want to do.
Sweet.
But obviously, as a child, I couldn't fully comprehend the enormity of a PhD. But obviously, you know, I wasn't even doing my GCSEs by this point. So, but I understood it to be a huge yet rewarding commitment, is sort of how I understood it in my brain.
Yep.
But yeah, so I was really introverted throughout my time at school, and nobody in my family had gone to university. So, although I got good grades, I didn't think PhDs were for people like me.
Yeah.
But then at my midwifery graduation, I watched the PhD students cross the stage to be awarded their PhDs, and I just felt a fire in my belly and I got goosebumps. And like, I remember this moment so clearly, and I often relive it when I'm facing challenges with my research. I just felt a like steely determination come over me, and I thought, I'm going to do that.
Excellent. And
yeah, here I am. I can't believe it's my reality, and I'm just so grateful that I get to do this and that people believe in my research enough to let me do what I love. So whilst I've always wanted to do a PhD, the deciding factor as to why I did it so soon after qualifying was that I was frustrated with the system in which I worked. So due to politics and time constraints, underfunding, chronic understaffing, midwives are kind of trapped into providing care that we feel is sometimes substandard because we're so stretched. So we learn at university, we learn about gold standard care, but then in clinical practice, it's so different. It's not possible to care for women and birthing people how we want to, for the reasons that we entered midwifery in the first place. And that's really sad, not only for us, but for them too. So I'm not, you know, berating individual trusts or
it's a universal problem, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's a systemic problem, but I realised I couldn't keep contributing to a system like this. So I decided to do something about it sooner rather than later, because so many midwives leave the profession entirely, and I didn't want to become one of those. You know, I knew at 14 I wanted to be a midwife, and I always want to be a midwife, even though I'm not going to be 100% clinical because I'm doing research. But I see that as a way of improving the care that people receive.
So. Oh, absolutely. So your research area, so your PhD area is in a third discipline. So you've gone from the nursing to the midwifery, and now you're entering the pre-hospital and the paramedic area.
Yeah, so I am researching UK paramedics' experiences of providing pre-hospital maternity care. And I decided to focus on this area because in my midwifery degree, in my third year elective placement, I'd arranged it with the ambulance service, and I absolutely fell in love with it. And I never left because pre-COVID, I continued to third man throughout the rest of my degree, and pre-COVID even doing, I'm looking forward to getting back to it again. And sort of stories from both the people that I cared for as a midwife and from the paramedics themselves opened my eyes to the reality of the paramedical scope of practice and their competence and confidence with regards to maternity care. So that's how I came up with my thesis idea. And I'm always thinking, if 5 years ago I hadn't done my elective placement with the ambulance service, then I wouldn't be here today doing what I'm doing, which is just crazy how, it's just completely shaped my life and career. Like, my PhD is my life. It's just crazy how I could be doing something completely different.
Which would still be just as valuable. There have been, people have been known to get two PhDs. So you've got a long future ahead of you.
Oh, there's the goal.
There you go.
There's my new goal.
You don't have to do a second PhD to make a difference, because then you can go into clinical, you can still be doing research and do postdocs and all those things. But how does that work? So with the different systems and different countries, so how do you be the third person in a crew as a midwife?
So I have. So when I third man with the paramedics, control know which crew I'm with, and then if there's a maternity job, you know, it's feasible for us to go to, it's not going to sort of put them at risk that it's going to take us too long to get there or anything, then they send the crew that I'm with. I have to be very careful because when I'm doing that, I'm not insured. You know, I'm not at work, I'm not insured as a midwife. I can't technically, this is where it's sort of a grey area, because technically I can't provide midwifery care because I'm not insured, I'm not at work. However, under the Nurse and Midwifery Council code, if you are outside of work, you are still required to, if you feel confident to, you know, care, you know, provide care in life-saving emergencies, sort of thing. So, and I've never actually come across that yet. However, for example, paramedics can't do the manoeuvres if a woman was having a core prolapse. It's outside of their scope of practice. Whereas obviously I can, if I came across that situation, whether with the paramedics or not, you know, with consent, I would offer to do that, you know, save the baby. Yeah.
So that's almost like something similar to the Good Samaritans Act, that you're there as a knowledgeable first aider.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and I have gone to, you know, I've cared for people as a community midwife, where I've called the paramedics themselves, you know, to home births or emergencies, and we've all sort of provided care together collaboratively, and then transferred the woman to hospital.
Yeah.
But I've never had to do anything where I haven't been at work and I've had to think, oh God, am I going to get struck off for this?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like I've over the years, I've stopped at a couple of car accidents and motorbike accidents and the same thing to stabilise until the ambulance get there. And then kind of like it's all been fairly simple. Thank goodness that it hasn't been anything beyond. Because you're sitting there going, I've got these skills, but I really don't want to use them. And I don't want to have to justify why I needed to use them at some times.
Yeah, exactly. It's in that situation, I just feel like any healthcare professional with any training would just do it. But then unfortunately, litigation and things afterwards do make you scared to do it. But I think
very much. But it's also, but it is, yeah, but very much. It comes under like an ethical and a moral responsibility that you've got the knowledge that you can help, and especially with birthing, that if you can keep the woman calm, if you can help with moving her legs back if a shoulder dystocia happens, and that can actually help facilitate a successful birth or with a cord prolapse, then, yeah, there's simple things that you can do that we don't think twice of in a hospital setting.
Yeah, exactly. I have been to, you know, when I've been out with the paramedics, we have gone to people just giving birth, and it's luckily there's been no emergencies. It's all been straightforward. But the paramedics are relieved that I'm there, and the women are also relieved that I was there. It just sort of keeps them calm. It's another pair of hands as well.
Yeah.
So obviously you've got two patients, as it were. So yeah, it's all been smooth up until now, luckily.
So how many events have you attended then while you pre-COVID?
I haven't actually kept note. I've been doing it for 5 years. I arranged it in my third year of my midwifery degree. And then, as I say, I just never stopped. I didn't, you know, when I did these shifts with the ambulance service on my midwifery degree, I didn't get signed my midwifery hours. It didn't contribute to that. I just did it on my days off just for fun kind of thing.
As you do.
And I've met so many amazing people as well through doing it, and made genuine lifelong friends from this. It's just been brilliant to do and see it from their perspective as well. Because then, when I was a community midwife, when I'd have to ring ambulances, I'd then sort of sometimes I'd even know who turned up.
Yes,
it's like working with your friends. It's so nice.
And that was one of the advantages when I was working as an emergency nurse. Is you get to know the ambulance crews very well, you get to know the local police very well, and you socialise with each other because you're all working same rotas, and it is, you keep seeing each other, and that's where you spend that downtime, or you deal with the traumatic, and that's what's a bonding experience for people.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. You know, some of them, we see each other, not during COVID, you know, but outside of work, they're genuine friends. It's so lovely, you know. I can learn things from them, they can learn things from me. Some of them now are training to be midwives or applying to midwifery degrees because they want to be dual qualified. Brilliant.
So has COVID given you extra time within your studies, or has it hampered your studies?
It's unfortunately hampered them. In fact, some of my colleagues have had to defer for a year. I haven't, luckily. In my first year, I nearly did. I had 4 surgeries and various inpatient admissions, and they repeatedly advised me to defer. But I didn't. I hung on, and I'm here. So I'm not letting COVID make me defer. If I got through that. I've had to change my methodology and my epistemological approach. But, everything happens for a reason. My research is even stronger now. So that's fine. I wanted originally, because I'm studying it full time, I wanted to complete it within 3 years. Because of these changes and because of, you know, my changes to my methodology, I think it might take 3.5. I want it to be done within 4 years maximum.
So what did you change it from and to?
So I changed it from an interpretive phenomenological analysis. So I'm doing face-to-face interviews. Well, my original plan was to do face-to-face interviews with paramedics through an IPA approach. However, I've now changed it. Obviously, well, I'm not going to begin conducting my research until this September. That's when I'm going to begin conducting my research, the interviews. So by September, we may well be able to do it face-to-face. You know, we're probably all going to be, those who have had the vaccine, we're probably all going to be fully vaccinated and, you know, still wear PPE and things.
Yeah.
Who knows? The world might be back to more normality. Face-to-face might still be able to go ahead, but I've had to write contingency plans, about using online software like Zoom or Skype or Microsoft. And I also changed it, so I'm using a more pragmatic approach to it now. That's what I'm doing. It just seems more sort of forgiving, not so strict. I know IPA can be challenging for a novel researcher. That didn't put me off. But I also want to interview more paramedics. I know the interviews won't be as sort of in depth. We won't gain maybe such rich data, but I feel like until I'm postdoc, I just sort of want to gain perspectives from as many paramedics as possible rather than, say, 5 really in depth.
Yeah. Are you going to be looking at participants from both rural as well as city?
So the ambulance service that I'm going to be conducting my research in is we're kind of suburban. So there are some areas which are rural and there are some areas, in towns. So I feel like I won't just be going to one station I'll be going throughout the stations within this ambulance service. So there should be a good mix from all, because obviously the results would really differ.
Yeah.
Between urban and rural.
So if you're not going to get your interviews done until this September, so what have you been finding when you've been doing the literature review and your background writing and searching in preparation for your interviews?
So I'm doing a professional doctorate. So it differs a bit to a traditional PhD, because in a traditional PhD, when you're applying, you'd already have your protocol and you'd present that at the interview. So you'd have your research kind of ready to go for as soon as you started. But on a professional doctorate, only a few universities in the UK offer it. So it's just different. For the first 2 years of it, you do modules and units to sort of, you're doing your literature review and you're developing your protocol alongside that. And alongside while doing that for 2 years, you're also doing other modules. So I've just yesterday submitted and finished a module about comparative health policy, which was really interesting. And so that's what I've kind of been doing the past 2 years, is doing other modules to develop my knowledge about research in general, but also developing my protocol ready to begin conducting my actual research in September.
So then what's your final product? Is it going to be a monolith of 80 to 100,000 words, or is it a different version?
Yeah, so it's going to be that, which sounds very daunting.
Yep.
But I feel like there's actually lots to write about. It feels incredibly daunting, but the assignments that I've been doing in these first couple of years are all sort of, they can be like 6 to 10,000 words. My master's dissertation was 24,000 words. And I feel like I did that in 6 weeks. I feel like in the time that I've got to do a thesis, it'll be fine. I've already got some chapters written. Obviously it will be revised. But I've started. So that's the good thing. But in the literature, I've just found that there's a distinct paucity of evidence regarding paramedics' experiences of providing pre-hospital maternity care. There's one Norwegian study which explored paramedics' experiences of providing intrapartum care. But my research is going to explore the entire perinatal spectrum from antenatal to postnatal. So it should be the first of its kind in the world, which is obviously the point of a PhD. But so the research found that Norwegian paramedics were frightened and anxious of birth and of complications, and they preferred a midwife's presence, but this wasn't always possible. And in that study, they discussed the lack of resources and knowledge and skills. And they said that because they weren't trained pre or post qualification, sometimes adverse events motivated them to undertake courses in their own time or try and arrange maternity placements in hospitals in their own time. To expand their knowledge and improve their confidence, because they all said that they felt dread when a maternity job came through. Yep. And speaking to my paramedic peers in the UK, this feeling seems to be mutual here too. There is one study in Australia actually that researched women's experiences of giving birth in paramedical care, and unfortunately most women reported negative experiences, and some said things like their trust in the ambulance service was broken and they felt like their privacy violated and things. It was quite shocking to read actually, and I'm sure the paramedics themselves, they don't want that, of course, but they It's not their fault at all. But, you know, because they just lack the skills and the knowledge, really. So one of the things I've been doing in the last couple of years is I contacted, in the UK, there's 46 universities that offer one or more form of a paramedicine degree. So yeah. I contacted all of them to find out about their obstetric education. And I found that between 0 to 2.7% of their curriculum throughout the entire 3 to 4 year degree is dedicated to maternity and obstetric emergencies.
Yeah,
so I find that quite small. I know paramedics are a bit like GPs in that they have to be generalists, but I still find that quite small.
But I also think about that it's, and I know that I've had experience with paramedics here as well, and we've been talking about trying to get, because we share a campus on my university. In fact, we're next door to each other in the buildings, in our simulation buildings, and we're trying to work out ways that we can work together and have the midwives give the lectures and how we can have the paramedic students work with midwifery students to do some joint activity. Because one of the things that we're also talking about is that they don't get to experience normal birth.
Agree. Then so what some of the, my paramedic peers have said to me is that sometimes they see a normal birth, when they're out in practice, but because they haven't had the training or exposure to it as a student paramedic, you know, they see the colour of the baby and they think, oh God, like, you know, the head doesn't deliver or the shoulders don't deliver quick enough. They think it's a dystocia or something. They don't know what's normal, basically.
Hmm. And so it would be interesting to see what comes out when you've finished and then looking at how we can better skill and work together. Because when you're thinking about, and like the discussions that we've had within my place, is trying to talk about how we can work together to teach the paramedic students that this is normal. This is what happens at a home birth. This is actually quite good and understanding because they get an idea of the physiology, but also running them through some normal scenarios and that it can take, if you don't have oxytocin, it can actually take kind of like a half hour to 45 minutes for that placenta to actually separate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that is a common point, like panicking the placenta hasn't come out in like 10 minutes or so.
Do your crews carry oxytocin or syntocin on their buses?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they do, luckily. I think it might be syntometrin. But, yeah, obviously that's contraindicated in hypertension. So sometimes people don't get it and then they're transferred into hospital and, yeah.
So do you have different levels of your paramedic qualifications and then ICU paramedics, or are they all the same kind of qualification level? Can they... Like for birthing, do they have to phone in to get orders to use the syntometrin, or can they just follow an algorithm to do it?
Yeah, they follow the algorithm. So there are, of course, different levels. They qualify as a band 5, as a newly qualified paramedic, and then after a couple of years, once they've completed other competencies and gained confidence, they go up to a band 6. And then a lot of paramedics can just stay at a band 6, but then, of course, you can undertake postgraduate qualifications to become, for example, a consultant paramedic, you know, if you did a full master's or something, or they can just do postgrad certificates or diplomas and other areas of critical care and things. There's a paramedic on my PhD actually that's he's a very experienced advanced paramedic, and now he's getting his PhD. So
oh good,
yeah,
because it's also looking at how much do they, and especially if you're going to be looking at the whole of the pregnancy experience, do they get called in for postpartum psychosis? Do they get called in for postnatal depression or even antenatal depression? Do they get called in for those type of things for the extreme situations?
Yeah, so that's exactly the reason why I wanted to not just focus on intrapartum care, because there are so many, that's a very small part, even for midwives, that's a very minuscule part of our practice. So it's only expected that it's a small part for paramedics as well. Obviously a lot of, because I submitted freedom of information requests to every ambulance service in the UK as well, so I've got all the data about the incident, like the number of labourers they're called to, the number of babies that they sort of facilitate the births for, and I've also got data about the incidence of all the various obstetric emergencies as well.
Nice.
So from that it just shows me it's not all about people calling when they're giving birth kind of thing. It is the whole spectrum of anything to do with the perinatal period.
So is that going to, are you looking to publish that, or is that going to be a part of the final documentation?
So, yeah, so one of my supervisors did recommend that I publish that as well. She recommended recently that I do that, so I will be looking at doing that.
Definitely be really interesting to have a look at, because everyone has, I probably the same over there as it is here, that we get to see the good news stories of the ambulance driver who delivered the baby.
And he said, oh, don't.
The bloody woman kind of gave birth. And the kind of paramedics happen to be there. But of course, media kind of puts it all out, and it's and we've had hassles with distances between centres and centres closing down, and of course with fires, floods and weather. But knowing those kind of stats, actually having those kind of stats, I think would actually be really eye-opening.
Yeah, it would. And there are a couple of Australian studies as well, fairly recent, which I've included in my literature review. But obviously there isn't anything in the UK, so that's why I had to submit these FOIs to get data from here. But yeah, it's pretty similar throughout the four countries of the UK. It's pretty similar to the incidents in Australia, actually, which is interesting.
That is interesting. And well, I mean, our healthcare's are different, but we've got different state ambulance services as well that all keep different records. Because it'd be really interesting to see what the Americans, but then again, you're dealing with 50 states and very different healthcare systems. But it'd be interesting to see what they do, because their paramedics are part of their fire department in a lot of areas.
Yeah, it would be really interesting. I looked at America for the unit I've just finished, actually. Not about my thesis, it was about comparative health policy. But I started looking, I had to compare several countries, and one of them that I picked initially was America, and so did the paramedic on my PhD, actually. He looked at America as well. And it just took ages to try and, because each state seems to operate differently. It's not like in the UK at all, or even Australia. It was, just completely different. But then I suppose obviously the Australian healthcare system is different to the UK, but the American one is different again. And then I compared it to Canada, and yeah, it's all really interesting.
Yeah, I think ours is, because we've got Medicare was brought in much later than the NHS, which is the public healthcare system that was kind of designed on the basis of NHS, like most of the things that we've got over here in Australia are designed on the basis of the UK, the Westminster system and our law system, and we've tweaked it over the years and decades to try and Australianise it and make it a bit more independent. But it is interesting when you're looking at the private organisations that come in as well that then do things slightly different and try to take over, and when they get governments who come in and try to privatise systems, which makes it even worse. But thankfully that hasn't happened with our paramedics, but it's still government owned. But we've had lots of issues with ramping and minimum staff, not enough buses going around, kind of ambulances going around, which adds on to the stress as well. So you've got that on top of the normal job stresses, which I think ambulance drivers were ranked to be the highest, most dangerous profession around in a recent poll, and looking at health professionals.
Recently, last year in the UK, this is slightly digressing, but it's kind of still relevant. I was looking at PTSD and mental health statistics for different healthcare professions, and I thought that it would be paramedics would potentially, because of all the other trauma that they see and emergencies, I thought they might have highest levels of PTSD and mental health problems and sickness absence to do with mental health. However, it was actually midwives. They had more time off work due to mental health problems, and they had higher incidences of PTSD than paramedics, which I found really interesting, actually. That was in the UK anyway.
Yeah, and I think there was a study a few years ago pre-COVID that looked at, and it was a UK study that looked at PTSD in midwives, and actually got a whole pile of midwives to do one of the PTS screening tools. And I think it was an astronomical amount that two-thirds of them could technically qualify as having some form of PTSD symptomology. And you sit there and go, that's just an amazing amount in a profession.
Yeah.
And now we've got COVID, and especially for you guys over there, and especially for countries that are outside of Australia that have been hit with it, that people are exhausted. People are, the healthcare system is kind of like exhausted. So it's what's going to happen in the next few years once the vaccines are kind of, even if the Pfizer one does need a third one to kind of top it at 12 months, which is not unexpected. But the response to this is going to be, it's going to be generational.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The future PhD students, like, this will be a brilliant topic for them.
Oh, yeah.
Exploring different aspects of this. Yeah, the impacts of COVID, definitely.
So where are you thinking with what you've done for your preparation for the reading that you've done around the literature so far, what are you thinking or predicting that you might find from these interviews that you're going to do?
So I'm thinking, obviously I'm trying not to be biased at all, but just purely, you know, obviously I have an idea from speaking to my paramedic peers and things. So what I think I will find is that, well, they'll sort of echo what the Norwegian study said, in that they sort of dread maternity jobs coming through, and that they don't feel they have the right, they're equipped with the right resources or skills and knowledge, and that they would prefer more training on it, both post and pre-qualification. Because some paramedics I've spoken to received absolutely no obstetric training throughout university whatsoever, and they were expected to read textbooks in their spare time, but they didn't go through exams to test their knowledge.
Yep.
You know, some paramedics that I've spoken to have qualified without ever having witnessed a birth or an obstetric emergency at all.
Yep.
Which is quite scary, and it's not their fault, it's a systemic issue. Some universities do offer a short maternity placement of a few days, but other universities, about half of them, don't. And of those that do offer a maternity placement, it could be in the community where emergencies are probably not going to occur. Obviously they do sometimes, but you know, they need to really be on delivery suite and the birth centre, so they're exposed to normal birth as well. But yeah, they need to see the management of emergencies. However, you know, in delivery suite and in the hospital, student paramedics are in competition with student midwives and medical students. Unfortunately, even though they only have a couple of days there, the student paramedics, but they're still not prioritised, which is really frustrating. But yeah, so anyway, postdoc, I want to become a consultant midwife, maybe in the ambulance service if I'm lucky enough. Not all, only a couple of ambulance services in the UK have a consultant midwife. The one I want to work at, they don't have one, so I'm hoping they want one in a couple of years.
Take your own job. Why not? Absolutely. Yeah. Show them why it's needed.
I tweeted them on Twitter.
But that's how, like, when you're thinking about change champions and you're talking about agents of change, it's looking at where the problem is, finding the evidence to say this is the problem, but more importantly, finding possible solutions and going, look, here's what your problem is, but this is a consequence if you don't do anything about it. But if you do this, this is what the benefits are going to be. And then kind of, because you want to turn it into something they can't turn down, here's the cost and the return of investment that you're going to get. By employing me in this role, then I'm going to be able to do this, this and this. Because do they get debriefing? Like, do they get to follow up on, and this is probably more than just births, but do they get to follow up on people so that they know if what they did was correct or not? And do they get debriefing for those events that, I know for critical events they get debriefing, but for a birth or something that's gone unexpected, because we know that it cannot necessarily go crazy for it to have an effect on someone's mental health.
Yeah, so they don't get to follow up due to patient confidentiality, and obviously because they're not in, the ambulance service isn't part of the hospital trust, so there's no way. Or even if they did look them up, you know, that'd be a breach of confidentiality. So, no, they don't know what happened to that person. They don't know if what they did was correct or not, or they don't know the outcome, they should get debriefings if it's, you know, if it's a traumatic situation. Definitely not all of them do get debriefings, no.
Because if you think, if they're not experiencing this an awful lot, they've got minimal training, they've got minimal confidence in their own skills because they don't see it that often, then that uncertainty of once they finish the job, they've left the hospital or the venue, and then they're kind of like going back to the base and then going, well, did we do the right thing? Should we have done something else? If you don't close that loop, you're actually adding to that professional stress.
Well, exactly, yeah, because sometimes, you know, sometimes when I was a community midwife and I'd call paramedics out, and some of them would say to me afterwards, you know, once we'd conveyed the woman to hospital, we'd then all sort of stand outside and they'd say, like, did we do the right thing? And yeah, and I could reassure them that they did, or, you know, say about, or they'd question me in something that I did, so that they knew to do it next time and things. But often that doesn't happen.
Which is why that role as a consultant midwife in the service is rather critical when you think about it, because they have a person they can call to on the way there that can talk them through, but they also have a person they can talk to afterwards to kind of go, well, this is what we did. And if there was some way to kind of get, and this is where I think this prevention of mental health issues within our respective jobs, whilst maintaining confidentiality, but still being able to close that loop, because once that loop is kept open, then that uncertainty can fester and grow.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there should definitely, this is something that I would, you know, like to develop if I was lucky enough to become a consultant midwife, a way for them to have feedback on it and know the outcomes, you know, obviously keeping to confidentiality, but there must be a way to do that. Does that happen in Australia or not?
I have to chase that up to kind of like find out. I know that in some of our services they did have some midwives that were connected to them by pure chance. And I know that we've got some dual qualified paramedic midwives as well, but they don't get it an awful lot, not in South Australia, but in the eastern states. But I'll put a call out actually, because I know a few AMBOs, and actually ask them what actually happens, because that would be a good conversation to start on Twitter, in fact.
Yeah, it would. Yeah, it'd be really interesting to see what other countries do as well.
Yeah.
You know, we can definitely learn from this is what I'm talking about this a lot, because I just finished this unit yesterday, but the comparative health policy, this is what I was looking at, about learning from other countries and what they do and then adapting it to suit your country.
And I think that's where technology has been a huge advantage, is the world has shrunk for access in a lot of ways, but also when we're looking at such countries with such high resources, which in Australia we're considered one, but within our own countries we also have areas that are not high resource, and so what happens in those areas as well, we can often forget about. And I think that's where we can learn from, is how do the health professionals in this case that live in those lower resource areas of our countries, how do they manage, how do they deal with it? And I know that with looking at some of the states, and especially some of the southern states in America, like the maternal mortality rate in some of the southern states in America is horrendous. It's been growing and growing, and a lot of that is related to government policy changes that has come through over the last kind of 5 to 10 years. And that's a big influence as well when you look at the changes that government makes to healthcare in different countries.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know what to say, I just agree.
Yeah, it's frightening sometimes when you think and go, but that's not best practice. We've got all this evidence here that says this is the way it should be. And it's like, because politics gets brought in, and it is. Politics is on every level. It's on the personal level, it's the community level, it's the venue, it's the healthcare system, it's the national, it's the international level. It's hard to keep fighting that sometimes as one person.
Yeah, and like, you know, other policies as well influence health policies, yep. Like, you know, economic and housing and socioeconomic status of people, as you were saying, everything influences health policy. It's probably why it's one of the most controversial policy areas, particularly as it can be life or death situations as well.
The sustainable development goals on what we take for granted in different countries and what we kind of go, yep, you can, you've got a doctor here, or where in other countries it's not. Yes, it is kind of gone slightly off the topic, but it is very interesting.
It is definitely.
So will you stay, are you hoping to stay in that local area where you are now postdoc wise?
Yeah, I think I am. I would love to, as I say, be a consultant midwife within the ambulance service that I'm conducting my research in. So, if I could work there as a consultant midwife, I would definitely stay. My supervisor is in Wales, one of my supervisors, and he joked, you can come to Wales and be a consultant midwife here when you postdoc. But I don't know if he was joking or not.
You never know. Never know. Stranger things happen. And so with all of this, because you've had to deal with, you've had to deal with ride-ons, you've had to deal with COVID, you've had to deal with delays in study and just life in general. So how have you been protecting your mental health and balancing your demands between your study and your other things that you need to do?
Well, I'd say it was kind of easier pre-COVID because the gyms were open. So I love powerlifting and martial arts, and obviously, well, the gyms have been open throughout some parts of lockdown, but not all of it. They were just open on Monday, so I've enjoyed going back. But previous to that, they were shut for months, so it's been really hard. You know, I've done the whole trying the yoga thing at home and things, and it doesn't, for me, it doesn't do the same as a bit of weightlifting. Yep. So I do enjoy going back to the gym, but I make sure I get out every single day for a walk. My PhD is my life, so I don't, it is stressful, but I enjoy it as well. So it's not like work for me. So I don't feel like I need too much time away from it, and particularly because I'm trying to get it done as quick as I can. I guess it's probably not a very good answer, but I do a bit of exercise and that's it.
It's we all do different things. And I think that there was an international shortage of kettlebells. Because of COVID lockdowns, and the only ones that I could buy were like very dinky, kind of like 1, 2, and 4 kilo ones, which are very cute, but hard to handle when you're trying to go up.
Yeah.
What's going to happen though when you stop? Like, because that's going to be, once you hand that document in to be marked, you've then still got time before it comes back. And how are you going to fill your time in that? I know this is still kind of like time in the future, but have you thought about what you're going to do in that interim period?
Probably just, do you mean pre-Viva or post-Viva?
Post-Viva,
oh gosh, I don't know. I'd probably just work full-time and try and pass the time. I think I would try and secure a role that, you know, maybe a consultant midwife role or at least a band 7 role. You know, do all I could to prepare for that and try and secure it in preparation for hopefully getting awarded my PhD. I'd probably just work full time, really. Go to the gym even more.
Fair enough. I mean, what would you recommend? So, because you've gone a more traditional pathway, some would say, with your postgrad studies, as you've done your undergrad, you've then done a master's, you've then kind of quickly gone into a PhD. A lot more of the midwives that I've been speaking to have done it in a much longer pathway and had more of a clinical career. And I'm not saying at all that either are right and either are wrong, because it is what suits you at the time that you're doing it. But what would you recommend for people who are wanting to do it young? Because we need you for the future to be qualified to be up there and helping. What advice would you give to students who are kind of like in their third year or who are starting to think about what they might want to do in the future and think that they may not be smart enough to do a PhD?
I'd say that if you get through your midwifery degree, then you are smart enough to do a PhD.
Excellent. Thank you. I agree.
That's the first thing I say, because the midwifery degree is really tough.
Yep.
If you can, you know, obviously a master's and a PhD are higher levels, but if you can get through the midwifery degree where you're working full-time in placement for free and yep. You know, because you're doing it for free, a lot of people have to work part-time as well just to earn money to live, and then you're also studying full time. If you can get through that, then you can get through PhD. I thought I wasn't clever enough to do a PhD, but here I am, I'm halfway through it. And if people want to do it young, then I just encourage that, really, because some people were supportive, but some people weren't supportive, because I think, I don't know, maybe jealousy, or they thought I was trying to climb the ropes too fast. I needed more, like many more years of clinical experience before undertaking postgraduate experience. So you do face a lot of backlash when you do it young. However, at the trust where I trained at, there was a consultant midwife in training, and she was fairly young. I think she was probably late 20s or early 30s at that time. And she was doing it, and I spent a day with her. I arranged a day with her as a student, and she just sort of cemented that this is what I was going to do. And I just wasn't going to listen to everyone telling me not to do it. Don't listen to what anyone else says. If you know that you're ready to do a PhD at any age at all, then you should do it.
Yeah, and it's interesting because there's a lot of other disciplines where that progression is just automatically assumed, that you will do your undergraduate, you will then do kind of either a master's or go do your honours and then go straight into a PhD. And it's seen as the normal process. And it's like, there's nothing wrong with that. And you go, so why are young health professionals in particular looked upon strangely when they do put their hand up and go, I'm really interested in research and I want to do it because I want to help change the future. And it's like, we should be encouraging this from the get-go.
Yeah, we absolutely should. And during I get a lot of messages from student midwives struggling with the research module and their degree because, well, from my experience, and I completely empathise with them, when I did my research module and my midwifery degree, it wasn't very interesting. It wasn't anywhere near as interesting as all the other modules we did, even though it was related to midwifery research. And a lot of people struggle with it. Research isn't presented as something that's interesting. And actually, when I was studying that module as a student midwife, I knew I wanted to do a PhD, and I thought, I don't want to do a PhD if it's anything like this. This is so mundane. It was the worst module. But I'm glad it didn't put me off. I thought, no, there are so many researchers and academics in the world. I know everyone's into something different, but it can't be this boring. I'm glad I didn't let that put me off.
I think as someone who teaches research to undergraduates, I completely understand that, because one of the first questions I ask is, how many people are absolutely dreading this topic? And all but maybe one or two people will put their hands up.
Yeah.
And you sit there and kind of go, no, I mean, and I think that really shows you how much it comes back to us as educators, that we have to have the passion about research. We have to be able to link it to the application of their clinical skills, because there's still this great divide between academic and clinical. And it's like, oh, if you're an academic midwife, you're no longer really a midwife. It's like, well, actually, we're the ones that are helping form the evidence and find the evidence to make sure what you're doing, we still work together. We just work in slightly different ways. The same as somebody may work in a birthing suite and somebody may work in a postnatal ward. It's the same kind of concept.
Yeah, exactly. Often midwives that don't work at all, academic midwives, they can, you know, people say they're not a midwife anymore and things like that. Luckily, because I've still got my NMC pin and everything, I'm actually waiting to be interviewed for a new role, actually, clinically. But you get kind of ostracised, and other midwives that I know that are in roles like this, they get told they're not a real midwife anymore and things. And it's like, excuse me, we're just equally as important, even if we're not providing clinical care 100% of the time. We're researching and finding the evidence to inform the care that you provide.
Yep.
So nobody's better than anyone else. It's like, hierarchy is something that I hate, even within the hospital. You know, the hierarchy, yeah. That's a whole other topic, but yeah.
Oh, very much so. Very much so. And I think that's trying to get the students to have, and I mean, one of the things I try and do is tell them to, basically, research is like being a CSI detective, is you have a problem and you need to find the evidence, you need to find the clues of what's causing it or how to make it better. And so reframing it and getting them to be passionate about an area, and I must admit, I've been blown away by some of the presentations that some students have done, because you go into it and kind of go, right, let's talk about honours, shall we? Because you can, what you're trying to do is like three PhDs. Let's bring it down to like a 4,000 word assignment. It's very small. It's very small. It doesn't feel like it, but it's very small. And then you go on to the, here's how you do it. So how did you find your supervisors?
My supervisors on my PhD at the moment.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they're brilliant. I'm so, so lucky.
How did you hook up with them?
So this did take me many, many months, and I was beginning to despair because obviously I'm not in the paramedicine field. I'm not a paramedic, so I don't know anyone. I don't work alongside anyone. My colleague who's a paramedic on my course, even he struggled, and he is a paramedic. And then we both, initially in the early days, we both had our eyes on the same guy. but my colleague Mark, he actually trained with him, so I thought, well, I've got to let him have him. In the end, he didn't go with him anyway. But I just emailed and phoned a lot of people in all four countries of the UK, and eventually I found my supervisor. Ideally, they need to have a PhD and practice clinically, and have their hand in research. And ideally as well, at my uni, it was a stipulation for them to be geographically close to you, even though during COVID we can't meet them face to face anyway. So he's in Wales, so it's a different country, but I'm more than happy to go there when COVID allows. It only took me a few hours, so luckily that was okay. And I'm just so lucky he's really high up in the ambulance service, and he's, more importantly, he's a really nice person. And my other supervisor, so we have to have one clinical practice supervisor, and the other one has to be a professor at my university. And I approached her, so I did lots of research. She's not in, she's a psychologist, a clinical psychologist, so her perspective on things is really interesting, and she is absolutely lovely as well. I honestly can't get over how lucky I am to have two amazing supervisors, because I have heard horror stories before from a few people. I feel really grateful to have these two.
There are many stories where the supervision relationship has broken down or has got hostile. And if you can't pick your supervisors beforehand, especially because you're in a really niche area, that finding those people that's suitable, then good luck finding your markers as well then, because that's going to be the other thing, to kind of like put a name of five up against. To do that, mind you can also go to Australia in that context, so there's probably some people down here that you might want to put on your list.
I am in contact with someone actually from Australia, which, because I've read all of her stuff, I've read her thesis and I've read all the stuff she's done post, it's Belinda Flanagan, I've read everything she's done postdoc as well, and I was like fangirling over her, and I thought one day I'm going to email her. I know she can't be my supervisor because she's not in the UK. But I just emailed her and she replied quickly, and I was like, I nearly had an MI. I was like, oh my God. And I talked to her a bit, and she's like, anytime you need any advice or information, then just contact me. So I've got her as a contact as well. And she was like, I'd love to meet you one day. And so, now I'm like, I'm coming to Australia.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that we can easily forget about in academia as well, is that we are so kind of like caught up in doing our research, and we do hear the horror stories of academia and of study. But if you find a paper that is really kind of switched on, that's really up your alley, I mean, and if you email that person or tweet them, the chances are they're going to communicate with you back, because it's always nice to know that somebody's read your paper. And it's to sit there and kind of go, yep, that's really good. And some people are really generous with their times of going, yep, that's good. And you start a conversation, and then they'll send you other people's or other papers, either their own or kind of like colleagues that are on similar areas. So I think those relationships, and I think that's part of the advantage of social media now, is a lot more academics are on, especially on Twitter, but LinkedIn as well, that you can make those approaches. But we all quite possibly feel that imposter syndrome, that they wouldn't want to speak to us because we're just lonely PhD students. but I think we're all going to get rid of that imposter syndrome. I think that just needs to be kind of kicked to the curb, because we're just on different levels of the same ladder and we help each other up.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely agree. Yeah, I was shocked when she replied to me so quickly. But yeah, so grateful. But it's I find it weird as well. So on my Instagram, I get a lot of messages from student midwives, qualified midwives, aspiring midwives, and I'm genuinely surprised when I reply to their questions, and some of them go, oh my god, I can't believe you've replied, thank you so much, and all this stuff, and I'm like, oh my god, why wouldn't I reply? Yeah. But sometimes, okay, it might take me a few days to reply, sometimes, but of course I'm going to reply to absolutely everyone. Like, we're all equal, we're all into midwifery, we should all be encouraging each other and supporting each other and building each other up. That's what midwifery is all about.
Being with women, absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for spending this time. Now, you've got a few different kind of publications out there on a few different areas, but we'll link into a few different things when we can.
No, thank you so much for having me on today. I've really enjoyed chatting with you. I could chat all afternoon.
I know, and this is what some of the kind of conversations and the chats would be like. I'd love to have a big formal one, and hopefully in the future when the world opens up a little bit more and I can kind of come do some travelling, it'll be nice to kind of catch up with people and kind of do a follow-up on all of the PhDs that haven't quite finished, and then I think I'll kind of like chase people down in the future years and go, okay, where are they now type episodes of what happened and what did you find out for real. So I think that's going to be planned for some future podcasts.
That sounds amazing. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that sounds brilliant.
Thank you for joining us today. You'll find all the links on Twitter, Instagram, and on the podcast website. If you are a midwife and you would like to share your research, your postgraduate studies, or even the quality improvement projects you are doing now, then email me at throughthepinard@gmail.com. Send me a tweet or send me a DM.